Okay. We're talking about the companion, the friend, 15th class of person, the associate, one who is closely associated, coming from the word to shepherd, and therefore by implication one who is a close associate, even as a brother's keeper. This is a friend. And this particular word is used quite a bit in the book of Proverbs, and it's often translated neighbor. And we see various things said about this one. In chapter 14, verse 21, it says, don't despise him, because he's close by you. So don't despise him. He that despises his neighbor sins, but he that has mercy on the poor, happy is he. This type of person also loves at all times. Chapter 17:17, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. We also see that he can be trusted. Chapter 27 and verse 9. See, he loves at all times. So you know it's more than just somebody who lives next door. See, this re'ah, as the Hebrew is therefore a close associate. He's one who loves you. He's a friend. He's a companion. He's an associate. He can be trusted. Chapter 27 and verse 9. Ointment and perfume rejoice the heart. So does the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. Isn't that beautiful? Rejoices the heart. I like ointment and perfume, the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. Beautiful. Really beautiful. It also says, though, don't become surety for a friend. Chapter 6, verses 1 through 3, don't become surety for him. He needs to bear his own responsibility. And chapter 17 and verse 18, also saying the same thing. A man void of understanding strikes hands. That is, he becomes surety. He becomes surety in the presence of his friend. So do that. We also see that your friend comes to know your personal life. Chapter 18 and verse 17. He that is first in his own cause seems just, but his neighbor comes and searches him. Your neighbor comes and searches him and finds out whether you're just or not. So this kind of a friend, he gets into your personal life. And we also see that friends will be noble and will rightly use their tongue. Chapter 22 and verse 11. He that loves pureness of heart, for the grace of his lips, the king shall be his friend. And so that's how you win friends. But we also see you've got to deal carefully with your friend. Since he's close by you, you need to give him preference. Chapter 24, verses 28 and 29. Be not a witness against thy neighbor without cause, and deceive not with thy lips. Say not, I will do so to him as he has done to me. I will render to the man according to his work. Don't do that. Have mercy on your friend. Chapter 25, verses 8 through 10. Go not forth hastily to strive, lest thou know not what to do in the end thereof, when thy neighbor has put thee to shame. Don't hastily strive, because he knows you, and he may expose you to the situation there. Debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another. But see that hears it, put thee to shame, and thine infamy turn not away. So you might hear something and have it wrong, and if you go to anybody else, you're going to be shamed in the end. Go to him alone. And then also chapter 25, 17 and 18. Withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house, lest he be weary of thee and so hate thee. A man that bears false witness against his neighbor is a maul and a sword and a sharp arrow. You want to give preferential treatment to your neighbor. You also have to be careful of flattery with your neighbor. And your neighbor flattering you, because he can spread a net for your feet. Chapter 27 and verse 14. He that blesses his friend with a loud voice rising early in the morning, it shall be counted a curse to him. The loud voice, making a real show, ostentatious, it borders on flattery. That's what we're talking about. It'll end up being a curse. You don't want to do that to your neighbor, to your friend. Just be honest and straightforward. Chapter 29 and verse 5. A man that flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. You hurt your neighbor when you flatter him. You need to be honest with him, straightforward. Chapter 27 and verse 10. Thine own friend and thy father's friend forsake not. Neither go into thy brother's house in the day of thy calamity, for better is a neighbor that is near than a brother far off. So make sure that you make use of your friends. Those that live close by you, those that have that affinity towards you and with you, don't despise them. Don't make an enemy out of a neighbor. And a friend will build you up, and you'll build them up in conversation. In chapter 27 and verse 17, iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. So we want to use that relationship. Okay. I want to cover now some categories of teachings real quickly, just a few. We've covered a whole lot already. First of all, I want to look at the nature of strife and contention. There's a lot said in the book of Proverbs about strife and contention. It's an everyday concurrence in life, I hate to say it, but it is. There's always things about us that cause strife and contention. The first thing we see in the Proverbs about strife and contention is that it's powerful and damaging. Very powerful, very damaging. Proverbs 18 and verse 19 says, "A brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city, and their contentions are like the bars of a castle." Your brother who is offended or discordant, or the idea is being wounded, he resists more than a strong city, it says. And strife resists more than bolts in the palace. These things are very difficult. Once one has been wounded, and once a discord has come between two and they've striven, the hurt that is there is very difficult because of pride and other things to come to a union and unity. And so you want to avoid it at all costs. You want to avoid it. So you don't want to come into those things. You want to be have the soft answer that turns away wrath. And things along this line, as we'll go to later. In chapter 18 and verse 14, it says, "The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity, but a wounded spirit who can bear?" You see, strife wounds the spirit. Strife wounds the spirit. When there's argument and contention at one another, see, that wounds the spirit, and that's so difficult to bear. In chapter 17 and verse 14, we also see how it spreads out so quickly. "The beginning of strife is as when one lets out water. Therefore, leave off contention before it be meddled with." Now, what happens when you let out water? Does it fall in a little clump on the ground and just stay there? No. It spreads. It rapidly spreads and sinks into the soil, and it's out of your hands, and it's just... it's gone. You can't retrieve it. You can't retrieve it. So once strife starts, it flows out. And so stop contending before strife starts. Realize, here comes the problem. See, in marriage, the same thing. Do it in marriage. Do it everywhere. The problem starts to rise, just stop. Uh-oh. Strife's starting. Let's just hold it. Count to 10. Go pray, you know. Bite your tongue. But don't say anything more. You know, just bring it to a halt and wait, because it's like the spreading out of, letting out of water. It's also like taking a dog by his ears. Chapter 26 and verse 17. "He that passes by and meddles with strife belonging not to him is like one that takes a dog by the ears." And dogs don't like to be taken by the ears. I have the sweetest German shepherd that, well, he sounds like a lion roaring when you take a hold of his ears. We see who it started by. Let's look at who starts strife. Chapter 26, verses 20 and 21. "When where no wood is, there the fire goes out. So when there is no tail bearer," that's the whisperer, that's one who rolls to pieces, the strife ceases. "As coals are to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife." So there's another instigator. The whisperer is one, the contentious man is one. Chapter 28 and verse 25. "He that is of a proud heart stirs up strife, but he that puts his trust in the Lord shall be made fat." So one who has a proud heart, he'll also start strife, because he doesn't want to back down. No humility in him. So he's going to stiffen his back, and he's going to get into a meddling affair. Chapter 29, verse 22. "An angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression." Somebody who's given over to anger and fury, you know, he's going to start it really easy. Chapter 30 and verse 33. "Surely the churning of milk brings forth butter, and the wringing of the nose brings forth blood. So the forcing of wrath brings forth strife." And you have that anger, and you just keep forcing it. Just keep forcing it. Just keep forcing the issue. You're going to get strife eventually. Even though they might be yielding and not reacting at first. So we see these instigators, the gossiper, the contender, the proud, the angry, and the wrathful man. We see that it takes an absolute, fair, authoritative arbitrator to settle strife. An absolute, fair, authoritative arbitrator. Chapter 18, verse 18. "The lot causes contentions to cease, and parts between the might be. You cast a lot, you get the answer of God, and it ceases. That's all she wrote. And that's what we need. We need the Word of God in situations like that. Let me throw in also James 3:16. For where envy and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. Strife is a beginner of every evil work. Other things that you would never do when you get into strife, you'll do them. You'd never do them otherwise. You'll do them when you're in strife. Every evil work. We see how strife must be dealt with. It must be dealt with tenderly but directly. Tenderly but directly. Chapter 15, verse 18. A wrathful man stirs up strife, but he that is slow to anger appeases strife. So you can stop it by being slow to anger. Also chapter 20 and verse 3. It is an honor for a man to cease from strife, but every fool will be meddling. Fools fall into strife so easy. Always meddling, picking at this, picking at that. They're fools. But an honorable man will cease it. Chapter 22 and verse 10. Cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. Yea, strife and reproach shall cease. See, the scorner, he's hurting people's feelings. He's slandering and gossiping. The scorner, you know, he's always, you know, speaking down on people and things. He always starts contention. Okay, a second class of teaching is there's a time to be secretive and a time not to be secretive. God is secretive at times. Chapter 25 and verse 2. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. God is secretive at times, and it's to His glory that He hides things, so that we have to walk by faith. We also see that we are to keep sin secretive. Chapter 17 and verse 9. He that covers a transgression seeks love, but he that repeats a matter separates very friends. We also see that we are to be secretive with secrets, huh? Chapter 11 and verse 13. A talebearer reveals secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit conceals the matter. There's a time to conceal the matter. Those that have knowledge, they hold back things. They're secretive. In chapter 12 and verse 23, a prudent man conceals knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaims foolishness. So a prudent man, he holds back his knowledge. We also, being secretive also holds away anger. Chapter 21, verse 14. A gift in secret pacifies anger, and a reward in the bosom, strong wrath. So there's a time to be secretive, just to secretively do something sweet for the person. And also chapter 22 and verse 3, another time to be secretive. A prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Be secretive towards sin. Hide yourself this time. But then there are other times not to be secretive. Chapter 9 and verses 17 and 18. Stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant, but he knoweth not that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of hell. And so there are times not to be secretive. That sin that you think is hidden, it's not. God sees it. So what are you supposed to do? Chapter 28, verse 13. He that covers his sins shall not prosper, but whoso confesses and forsakes them shall have mercy. So, get the sin out in the open. Confess it. Get rid of it. Deal with it. Be gone with it. There's another thing not to be secretive about, and that's love. Chapter 27, verse 5. Open rebuke is better than secret love. Open rebuke is better than secretive love. That means if you're going to hide your love, at least rebuke them. In other words, let there be some interaction. It's a horrible thing when 10 years down the road, somebody comes up to you and says, you know, these last 10 years I've just loved you dearly. And you feel like saying, why didn't you tell me? I wish I'd have known. You know, I could have the benefit of your love all these 10 years and I didn't have it. I wish you'd at least rebuked me, cared for me enough at least to have some interaction with me. It's that which every joint supplies. Do they have no joints? You have no supply. So be joined. Okay, a third class of teaching is the leading of God. The leading of God. Proverbs chapter 16, verses 1, 3, and 9. Beautiful little truth here. It says, the preparations of the heart in man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. But it's literally a little bit different than that. Literally, it's the preparations of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. What do we see? We see that it is up to us to prepare our heart, or as the Hebrew means, to arrange. The arrangements of the heart belong to man. We are the ones that set things in order in our heart. And as we do that, then God gives us the answer of the tongue. That is, He helps us in our day-to-day spontaneous reactions and responses. In other words, you determine to walk with God, He helps you. He helps the living out of it. In verse 2, it says, all the ways of man are clean in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the Spirit. See, the problem with us is we want to lead our own life. We want to do it all ourselves, and that's wrong. We shouldn't do that. We should let the Lord give the answer of the tongue. Verse 3, commit thy works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts shall be established. See, that's what we're to do. Commit your works to the Lord. In other words, leave everything in God's hands, and then God will establish the things that you prepare in your heart and in your mind. See? So be faithful in the preparing of your heart, and be faithful in the faithfulness, and He will supply the success. And then look down at verse 9. A man's heart devises his way, but the Lord directs his steps. You see, we must have the motivation. It's up to us to have the right motives and the right attitude. But it's up to God to produce the success. Now you see, chapter 21, verses 29 and 30. A wicked man hardens his face, but as for the upright, he directs his way. There is no wisdom, nor understanding, nor counsel against the Lord. So you see, the righteous man, he doesn't set his heart against God. He opens it up to God, and then the Lord is the one who builds the city, as it were. Now, the mind is a very fertile field, and it's able to produce all kinds of leadings and all kinds of other things. Chapter 19, verse 21. There are many devices in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the counsel of the Lord, that shall stand. So we can have all kinds of ideas in our own mind. But ultimately, it's God that counts and how He's going to direct your life. And man tends to feel that his way is right. Chapter 16, verse 25. There is a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is the ways of death. We are like that. So, really, we must understand that we do not know why and how so many things happen. We must set our heart before God and be obedient and submissive to Him. And then allow God to work out the details and to bring forth the actual production of it. Because the preparation of the heart belongs to us, and then God will direct our steps. Chapter 20, verse 24. Man's goings are of the Lord. How can a man then understand his own way? See? See what we need to do? So you just get the right attitude and the right motives, and then let God direct your steps. Also, chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct thy paths. Praise the Lord. That's right. So we set everything at the hands and the feet of Jesus, and then we make sure our heart is right and our attitude is right, and then we trust the Lord as far as the actual direction of our life. Okay, let's look at some other truths of blessed living. Just some real quick one. Chapter 16, verse 32, we see the beauty of self-control. You know, there's just nothing that can replace self-control. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city. Now, you can't get much more famous than if you take a city. There's not hardly any greater power than that. If you rule your spirit, you're greater than him. The beauty of self-control. Secondly, in chapter 18, verse 24, we see the weakness of man, yet God supplied. A man that, and I gave this to you, I guess, the other day, a man that craves companionship will come to ruin, but there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. Another truth is to become one with your spirit, and even your soul, to submit unto the spirit, your spirit that is in yielding to God. Chapter 20, verse 27, says, the spirit of man is the candle of the Lord, searching all the inward parts of the belly. Our soul gets so easily confused, easily deceived. Therefore, we must yield to the Spirit. And the Spirit is a candle of the Lord. The Lord uses our spirit to search in us, and that's how we come to know who we are and what we are, is through our spirit. And that's why it's such a folly to go by our carnal reasoning, and especially when your spirit is drawing you. Chapter 22 and verse 1, we see things that really count. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. Basically, in other words, live a faithful, godly life and build a good reputation. That's more important than all the rest. We also see that hard work must come first in your life if you're to succeed. Chapter 24 and verse 27 says, prepare thy work without and make it fit for thyself in the field, and afterwards build thine house. You got to have enough foresight. You can sleep on the field for a while. You can go for a little while in the inconvenience of that outdoor living. But if you don't get your crop in soon, you're going to go without food for a whole year. So you've got to think ahead. Also, don't be a bum. Chapter 25, verse 17, withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house, lest he weary of thee and so hate thee. Also, I want to look in chapter 30, and we see certain categories of things that you and I should get to understand. Let's turn to chapter 30. And there are certain categories of things that we are to understand their nature. Let's look at verse 15. The horse leech has two daughters, crying, give, give. There are three things that are never satisfied, yea, four things say not, it is enough. So there are certain things that are never satisfied, and we need to know those things. Now it says three, yea, four. You know what that means? That means that there are many. It's a basic category. This is an Arabic expression, a Hebraism. 3a4, or 2a3, or 6a7, meaning that there are many things in that category. And they have a consistent and continual nature like that. They don't change. See, it's a consistent, continual nature. And so 3a4 things that are never satisfied. Now, why do you need to come to know the things that are never satisfied? So that you can learn in life not to set your whole life on them, because they'll never be satisfied. So why pursue them to satisfy them? They'll never be satisfied. So just rest content with moderation. So let's look at some of these things. Verse 15. 16, excuse me. The grave and the barren womb, the earth that is not filled with water, and the fire that saith not, it is enough. I'm sure there's more revelation than we can even get into here. But death is never satisfied. Always there will be more to die. And so just realize, you're going to come there. And the barren womb, it's never satisfied. And the earth that is not filled with water, it's always going to keep going, so there's no ultimate good in it. And the fire that saith not, it is enough. The fire is never satisfied. It'll keep burning and burning and burning. As long as you keep supplying, it'll keep burning. And so you learn the nature of certain things. Like strife here. It's never strife will go on and on and on. It's like a fire that burns. Certain needs in your life, your appetite, There's certain things that always will come back for more. Verse 18 now is the second category of things. There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not. So now we need to understand the categories of things that are unpredictable. They're just beyond you. You'll never get the full understanding of them. They're unpredictable. What are they? The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. They're unpredictable. You can't force them to be a certain way. And so just leave them alone. You can't force it to be a certain way. You never know how the wind's going to make that ship go. You never know how that eagle, it's not going to be always the same way. That serpent on the rock. These things are too wonderful for us. The way of a man with a maid. See, you just can't force it into certain things, certain molds. You have to leave some of these things be. They're never the same either. Yes?
What do you mean by serpent upon a rock? The only one that I don't even...
Well, the way, he's going to move all kinds of different ways. You never know what he's going to do. He's unpredictable in his reactions. You never know what he's going to do. He might slither away, he might strike, he might go off the rock this way, he might go off the rock that way. Just never know. All right, verse 21. We see another category of things.
Mark?
Yes?
I've been waiting all semester
to get
to this
bird. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to do a little bit more discussion than that. There's something else there that I wanted to comment on. In each of those that's what I was talking about, the church on a rock. That's one of the things that was strange. But the church on a rock is just betraying itself. And when a church moves on a rock, it's graceful. An eagle in the air, I've seen them dancing in the air, especially their courtship dance here. Extremely romantic.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the ship on the sea, is a picture of beautiful poetic motion. And a man with a maid is also a picture of beautiful poetic motion.
Mm-hmm.
And I just.
Well, I think it's definitely not talking about romance in all four of these, that's for sure. It's talking about that which is too wonderful for me. That is, it's awe. It's beyond what your mind can absolutely predict and determine the way it's going to be. Because you have to adapt to each individual situation. You have to adapt. That ship is not going to have just this absolute, it's got to adapt to the winds and the waves, it's got to adapt to the wind and everything else. It's got to adapt to what the weather is. The eagle in the air, same thing. It's never going to be exactly the same. It's going to catch different wind currents. Every day is going to be a little bit different. And he's so free. And the serpent on the rock. You're not going to be able to just lay down. He's going to do exactly this. You don't know. You don't exactly know. And the way of a man with a maid. You don't know exactly what's going to. It's so unpredictable. Courtships are as different as people are different. The way people are relating. And so it's unpredictable. It's something you don't want to force down a certain mold. And we need to understand things that are like that so that we are not quick to judge, so that we're not quick to categorize, so that we're not quick to, recognize these things are too wonderful for us. And so there's a category of things like that in the world. And these are just examples to point out to all kinds of things that are like this. That recognize things that are too wonderful for you. Recognize things that can never be satisfied. Recognize things that are unpredictable. You need to know those things, so that you deal with them properly in life. And so this is an example that we see here. And it's just beyond, you just don't know. You can't just force it down a certain mold. You just can't do it. There are certain principles that you follow, and there's principles that the ship follows, that the eagle follows, Lift, temperature, wind speed, all of that. There are principles that you operate on. They're like the man with the woman. There's principles that you operate on. But every situation is so different. It's unpredictable. It's too wonderful for us. Mm-hmm. All right, there's a third category, or are we down to the fourth category? Third category, verse 21. For three things the earth is disquieted, and for four which it cannot bear. Now, there's also a class of things that are unbearable, to be avoided at all costs. There are some things that are just so bad that you want to avoid them at all costs. For a servant when he reigns, and a fool when he is filled with meat, for an odious woman when she is married, and a handmaid that is heir to her mistress. All of these things are people in a low estate that are exalted. Every one of these. People in a low estate that are exalted. And not just a low estate, but these people are not worthy of this position. These people have not earned this position. And it creates pride in them, and it creates a despotic rule in them. And they are going to lord it over others. And that's the thing that we want to avoid at all costs. We want to avoid at all costs. So be careful. Like Paul told Timothy, lay hands suddenly upon no man. The fourth category is found in verse 24. There be four things which are little upon the earth, but they are exceeding wise. Uh-huh. Now these are things that seem to be insignificant, and yet in them is a great wisdom. We need to learn in life what things, though they are insignificant, are very wise to do. What are they? Ants are people not strong. If they prepare their meat in the summer. It's insignificant, but look at they use foresight. Foresight is a very important thing. Insignificant, and yet it brings great wisdom. Foresight. The conies are but a feeble folk, yet make their houses in the rocks. Though you be little, if you find the solid, immovable mass and build your house there, that is great wisdom in Christ. The locusts have a coney is like a rock chuck, if you're familiar with them. The locusts have no king, yet go they forth all of them by bands. Here we go. Being united, so important, seemingly insignificant, but keeping unity is such a powerful thing of wisdom. And the spider takes hold with her hands and is in king's palaces, and it's probably here referring to the lizard. And here it is. He keeps himself in the corners, and he moves quickly, and he keeps himself hidden, and he's going to end up in the king's palace. He's subtle. He's wise. To be a strategist is a wise thing. You're going to end up in the king's house. And then the last category is verse 29. There be three things which go well, yea, four are comely and going. Now these are things that are noble in themselves. Just in themselves they're noble. And so you want to find in life what things to associate yourself with, and it'll bring you nobility regardless. Verse 30, a lion which is strongest among beasts, so be bold as a lion, boldness, and turns not away for any. A greyhound is quick, fast, and it's girt up in the loins, as it were here. And so you want to use speed, diligence. A he-goat also. And a he-goat, of course, is a strong animal, a bold, confident animal. Confidence is good and noble in itself. And a king against whom there is no rising up. And so if you can be the king, you've got nobility in itself, in certain positions. So we need to understand these things as they relate to all of life. Now, I did a study on the mouth, and I've got about three pages, and I'm just gonna rip through it real quickly. I'm gonna give you an idea of the type of thing to do in your assignment. Those of you that are gonna do an assignment on the tongue, I mean, I'm gonna go fast. What I'm gonna do is I'm just gonna give you a category, and I'm just gonna rattle off a few scriptures. And because a basic theme of the Proverbs is the use of the mouth. And there are loads and loads of scriptures relating to the mouth and use of the tongue and the lips and words and so forth. Let me just give you several categories. Let me tell you how I did my assignment. All I did is I just started looking up all kinds of verses. I'd look up a verse and I'd see what the theme of it was, and I'd write out that theme. And then if I got another verse that was in another theme, I'd write out that theme. And I just kept making new themes, and then I'd get verses that related to a previous theme, and I'd keep adding those verses in. By the time I was done, I'd gone through oodles of scriptures, and I had all these various categories. And then, you know, just rearrange them on your paper. That's all you have to do. First of all, to speak what is right delights God. You know that? To speak what is right is delightful to God. And chapter 12, verse 22. I'll pull out one of the many that I've found. Okay? 12:22. Lying lips are abomination to the Lord, but they that deal truly are His delight. Oh, God loves people that talk right. Secondly, God hates a lying tongue. He hates a lying tongue. Chapter 12, verse 22, same verse. Lying lips are abomination to the Lord. Thirdly, to flatter is to be worldly, or to be of the world. Chapter 28 and verse 23, and also chapter 2 and verse 16, the wicked woman. She flatters with her lips. Fourthly, put away a deceitful mouth. Don't be deceitful. Be honest and straightforward in your speaking. Chapter 17 and verse 20. He that hath a perverse heart finds no good, and he that has a perverse tongue falls into mischief. So don't have a perverse tongue. Don't twist things in your mouth. Fifthly, your mouth is your snare. Chapter 12 and verse 13. The wicked is snared by the transgression of his lips, but the just shall come out of trouble. Sixthly, right words will prosper you. If you speak right words, it'll prosper you. Chapter 13 and verse 2. A good man obtains favor of the Lord, but a man of wicked devices shall he condemn. That's not 13:2, that's 12:2. 13:2. A man shall eat good by the fruit of his mouth, but the soul of the transgressors shall eat violence. The good of your mouth, so right words will prosper you. Seventhly, the fear of God causes us to hate a false mouth. The fear of God causes us to hate a false mouth. Chapter 8 and verse 13. It says, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the perverse mouth do I hate. Let me list off the earmarks of a tongue that's not in submission to God. A tongue that's not in submission to God. Chapter 10 and verse 11, it conceals violence. I'm glad I'm reading and not taking notes like you right now. Chapter 10, verse 14, it produces ruin. Chapter 10, verse 32, it speaks falsely. Chapter 11, verse 9, it destroys his neighbor. Chapter 11, verse 11, it tears down a city. Chapter 12, verse 18, it speaks rashly. 14, verse 3, it reveals pride. 14, 25, it's treacherous. 15, 1, it stirs up anger. 15, 2, it spouts folly. 15, 4, it crushes the spirit. 15, 7, it withholds knowledge. 15, 28, it pours out evil. 16, 27, and 28, it's a fire that scorches and spreads strife and separates very friends. 17, 4, it loves wicked talk about others. 18, verse 23, it answers roughly. Ooh. 19, 28, it spreads iniquity. 20, verse 25, it makes rash vows. 24, verse 2, it talks of trouble. In other words, negative talker. Number 20, chapter 24, verse 4, it calls the wicked righteous. 25:8, it harshly argues his case. That is, the tongue and not in submission to God is a self-justifier, always trying to justify himself. 29:5 and verse 9, it reveals the secrets of another. 25:14, it boasts of his gifts falsely. 25:18, it's like a club, sword, and a sharp arrow. 26:4, it answers a fool according to his folly. 26:7, the word of God is powerless in his mouth and gives honor to a fool. 26:21, it kindles strife. 26:25, it speaks graciously to cover hate. 27:1, it boasts of tomorrow. 27:2, it praises himself. 28:13, he covers his transgressions. Chapter 30, verse 6, it adds to the word of God and exalts himself. That's the earmarks of a tongue not submitted to God. Now, what's the earmarks of a tongue that's of the righteous? The earmarks of a righteous tongue. Listen to this. Chapter 10, verse 11, it's a fountain of life. Chapter 10, verse 13, it has wisdom that shows a discerning heart. 10:20, it says choice silver. 10:21, it feeds many. 10:31, it flows with wisdom. 10:32, it brings forth what is acceptable. 11, verse 13, it conceals a matter. 12, verse 17, it tells what is right. 12:18, it brings healing. 12:25, it makes a heart glad. 14:25, it saves lives. 15:1, it turns away wrath. 15:2, it makes knowledge acceptable, it is soothing, and it's a tree of life. 15:7, it spreads knowledge. 15:23, his apt answer brings joy. His timely word is delightful. 15:27, his pleasant words are pure. 15:28, he ponders how to answer. 16:13, the sweetness of his speech increases persuasiveness. Sounds good. Are you so busy taking notes you're not able to enjoy what I'm saying? 16:24, his words are pleasant like a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. 18:4, they're as deep waters. 17:27, he restrains his words. 19:1, he walks in integrity. 20, verse 15, more precious than gold and jewels. 23:9, he doesn't speak to fools. Chapter 9, verse 7, he rebukes a wise man, but not a scoffer. 24:25, he rebukes the wicked, and he gets blessed. 25:11, his words are like apples of gold in baskets of silver. 25:15, his soft tongue breaks the bone. That's right. His soft tongue breaks the bone. That means if you really want to get some rebuke done, have a righteous tongue. And you'll be able to rebuke properly and it'll break the bone. I mean, it's really going to accomplish, you know, the depths of the thing that you're out to do. 28:13, it confesses his sin. Jesus said, let your yea be yea. And your nay, nay. And that which comes more of this is of the evil one.
our tongue needs to be in submission to God. And if we yield our tongue to God, we'll be able to bridle our entire body. If we can control our speech, we can control our life. And so I'd like to challenge you, brethren. Pick up the challenge of the Proverbs. Get that tongue under control. Bridle it. Because such a little member turns about such a great thing. My last thought in the Proverbs is found in chapter 31 and verse 31, the last verse. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. You'll be blessed or cursed depending on how much wisdom you have. Because wisdom will produce its own fruit. Wisdom will produce its own fruit. And great is the blessing of the man that walks in wisdom and hearkens unto wisdom. This is a concept that goes throughout the book of Proverbs, and that is that there are consequences to every single thing that you do. Every single thing that you do. The attitude you have in Bible college classes. The diligence of your life. The attitude you take when you're in a test. The daydreaming that you might go through. The way you treat others. What you think every minute has consequences. The way you think can really affect how you're going to live. See, just what do you do with that extra 5 minutes? That'll affect you. Everything has consequences. Everything. And we see the in the Proverbs how to falsely take responsibility for another's actions is really folly. And everyone needs to bear their own fruit. They need to bear their own fruit. In Galatians 6 and verse 7, be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. If we sow to the flesh, we shall reap corruption. If we sow to the Spirit, we shall reap everlasting life. Matthew 11 and verse 19, Jesus said, wisdom is justified of her children. Wisdom's always going to have the last say. Always. Because wisdom will produce the greatest fruit, ultimately. And so that's why we want to walk in wisdom. If we walk in wisdom, the blessings are going to catch up to you, overtake you, and overflow you. If you'll walk in wisdom. And it's not always immediately seen. It takes time. But wisdom will always be justified over children. So you can't change the truth. You can only either reject it or submit to it. Thus ends the book of Proverbs. Dave. Yes. Oh, okay. Proverbs 31, verse 6 and 7. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto them that be of heavy hearts. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more. Now notice, before that it says, it's not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings, nor for princes. If you want to be of sound mind and of stable judgment, don't drink wine. But to him that is of a heavy heart, and to him that is, you know, he can't face life anyway, he'll go into wine and he'll forget his problems, and there'll be a temporary benefit to kind of mollify the difficulty he's going through. Now, that does not mean that in the Church of Jesus Christ, if anybody's got problems, we should send him down to the nearest tab, you know. What this is meaning is this. The wine, it says, to one that is ready to perish, those that be of heavy hearts. What does wine represent in Scripture? It's a blessing of God. It's a fruit of the vine. That person needs to have somebody rush in and bless him. He can't think straight anyway. He's not in a position to be a king or to be a prince. And frolicking and, you know, that which comes with the drinking of strong drink. And the strong drink was often a mixed wine that, you know, would have a tremendous inebriating effect. And that's not for anybody that's going to be of sober judgment. That's not going to be for anybody that's going to want to have a position of dominion. It's not for him. And so it's a truth at that time. Now realize that the wine isn't like our wine today either, anyway. But to the person that's going to perish, boy, he needs help. He's not able to face these decisions anyway, so he needs help. He needs something to maybe get him through a difficulty. You know, it's like a person that's really in a bad state mentally. They're really, you know, ready to perish or just sorrow of heart. You can't force them into a lot of decisions right then. You just can't. You can't now. Just snap out of that now. He can't snap out of it now. So he needs something to kind of carry him through and kind of cover it up for a little bit. Now, even as they find sometimes a person that's really going through it mentally, if he will be given some drugs or something that will just slow his mind down and just get his mind to slow down, he can start getting a little bit of sleep and start, they'll get so wound up, they'll go into insanity. If they can just get slowed down a little bit and get some sleep and just kind of forget things for a little bit, then they're able to face it better later. And so that's how we are to relate to people that are, you know, ready to perish. Don't demand, you know, just a quick decision of them. Rush in and help them, and then they'll be able to face it later. They'll be able to deal with it later. So, okay, Book of Ecclesiastes. The Book of Ecclesiastes. This book has always had a special place in my life. My wife and I, before we were married, back in PLU, we one time went down into the bottom of the library in the lower floor, and it was just, nobody was down there. It was the empty archives down there. We sat down and we read the Book of Ecclesiastes. And we came out of that place two different people. We just sat down and we didn't talk to each other, I don't think, did we? We just read through that book and God met us in such a marvelous way. We came out of that place feeling like we were in a different world. And I hope that that's the same thing that will happen to you after we go through this book. Because it gives you a view of life that is so necessary. So necessary. If you're going to live life rightly, you need the revelation of this book. This book is so... I'm so glad it's in the Bible. This book is full of revelation. It really is. There's a basic main truth that keeps coming up again and again and again that needs to be repeated. Verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. So they're the words of the preacher. The Hebrew here for preacher is Koheleth. K-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. It's in the feminine. It means a lecturer or an assembler or a teacher or a preacher. If you were to give it a title, a Koheleth is a master of assemblies. In other words, it's a person who holds a certain authority to call an assembly of people to listen to his words. And it's an assembler. And so it represents Jesus Christ, who is the head of the church. He's the assembler of the church. He's the preacher. And he's going to give us revelation, a certain view of this life. Also, we are the ones that are to assemble the people of the world and give them the truth. So we are also that Koheleth, feminine. Now, where does the word Ecclesiastes come from? Ecclesiastes is the Latin form of the Greek word for preacher. For preacher. You've heard of ecclesia? That's an assembler, you know, an assembly. Ecclesiastes is the Latin form of the Greek. See, it comes from the Greek, actually, but Ecclesiastes is the Latin form that speaks of the one who is a caller out of an assembly. He's the one who calls out the church. Now, this preacher is definitely Solomon. There is a lot of discussion. Different ones want to argue the point, but it's clearly Solomon. Notice he was the son of David, and he was king in Jerusalem. Also, verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Verse 16, it says, I had more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. And that includes David, because he was the son of David. Now, who had more wisdom than David? Solomon. It's Solomon. Also, chapter 12 and verse 9, he talks about himself, and he wrote up many proverbs and sang many songs, and he was king in Jerusalem. It's Solomon. Now, what is the book of Ecclesiastes? Basically, it's a sermon. It's a sermon. It has a theme with an introduction, the development of the thought, and then a final conclusion and application. Now, this is really important. What is the purpose of the book of Ecclesiastes? What is the purpose in this sermon? The purpose is to search for the chief good obtainable in this life. That's the purpose. It's the search for the chief good obtainable in this life. Now, what's the method of this search? And this is important to understand. The method of this search is through the natural man. Through the natural man. Through experience on this planet. Observation on this planet. By inductive reasoning of the things that are observable and of touching by the natural man. In other words, basically, it's a search by sight. Not by faith, but by sight. Walking by sight. It would be as if an honest, unbiased, undemonized, unsaved man were to view all of life in great wisdom and find if there's a chief good in this life. And he's only using the natural means. That's all he's using. He's just viewing this life and he's hunting for the chief good in this life. That's all. And it's an excellent thing to do. Because it's when you do this that the unsaved man can relate to it. He can relate to this. Because that's the way he views life. Now it starts right out with the conclusion of the sermon. Verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's the conclusion. Vanity. In the Hebrew it's hebel. H-E-B-E-L. It's the same, that's where we get the word Abel. Cain and Abel. Abel means vanity. Emptiness. Nothingness. That's the way Adam and Eve felt after they got kicked out of the garden. Emptiness and nothingness. It also carries the idea of transitoriness and unsatisfactory. But then it's made in the superlative. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. That's what he found in this life. You try to find the chief good in this life, the conclusion must be vanity of vanities. All is vanity. You're not going to find it in marriage. You're not going to find it in job. You're not going to find it in personality. You're not going to find it in friends. You're not going to find it in anything that this world has to temporarily offer. It's nowhere to be found. Nowhere. Can't find it. All is vanity. Everything he considered and viewed in this life under the sun was vanity. Now, what's the question that the sermon is going to answer? It's found in verse 3. The conclusion is in verse 2. The question that he's going to try to answer is in verse 3. What profit has a man of all his labor which he takes under the sun? What's the profit? Of course, the implication has already been that there is no profit. In other words, of all the labor of man, there is nothing that is observable that brings a real or enduring or satisfying result. Boy, now that's vanity. Then what are we living for? See, we're going to go through all these reasonings, all this reasonings by this wonderful man, Solomon. And you see, it's inspired. It's an inspired search. There's no demonism in it. There's no carnality in it. All it is just the viewing through the natural man. That's all. So, I know you're going to enjoy it.